This morning we continue in this series as we have been working our way through the book of Exodus. We've been looking at the life of Moses because what we've been talking about for several weeks is adversity. And the truth is, sooner or later, you're going to deal with this because life isn't always sunshine and rainbows, is it? No, sometimes you go through hardship, difficulty, suffering, adversity. And the question all of us have to answer is, how are we going to go through it? How do we go through it well? And so we've been looking at Moses' life because Moses is a character in the Bible who both got used mightily by God, but also went through a great deal of adversity of all different varieties. And while we're looking at his life, what we're really looking at is God's character. We're reading the story, but what we want to know is, who is this God that Moses follows, that we follow, and well, what does he do when we're dealing with adversity? When life gets rough, what can we expect from him? What is his character like? How does he show up? Does he help us? Does he just leave us in it? What does God do when we go through adversity? And we've already learned a couple really important things about the nature of adversity and the character of God. The first thing is that, well, your experience will not very often tell you much about what God is doing. Because salvation is of such a nature that it's very often happening in the background. It's under the surface. It's unseen. God tends to work in quiet and mysterious ways. Salvation is most clearly seen on the other side of it. So you can always look backwards and see very clearly what God is doing, but in the middle of it, it's very often unperceived, yet it goes on anyhow. And so at the very same moment when God is actually working salvation out in your life, your experience of that moment can be one of adversity, hardship, and suffering. This is true for Israel. Their experience was that of slavery and of oppression and the burdens that Pharaoh put on their back. But what God was doing was making them into a mighty nation. The more they were oppressed, the stronger they got. And at the very same moment they're being oppressed, God is raising up a leader to lead them out of oppression. But they did not know it at the time. So your experience of difficulty, suffering, and adversity usually won't tell you much about what God is doing. That's the nature of salvation. But if that's true, then what it means is we have to learn to live our lives in such a way that we can act, make decisions, live as if salvation is already on its way, even when we can't see it, because it is, and we want to cooperate with that. And who knows how God is going to use your life in the greater plan of salvation? Because what we see in the story is that when God begins to save, he often begins with people and places that the world has written off as insignificant. And so if God was going to do an incredible act of salvation today, he would probably begin, well, in a place like this and with people like us. So don't discount your life. Don't imagine like it doesn't matter. Don't act as if God doesn't see. He does. He knows. And you have no idea how God will use you. But you have to make sure that in the midst of difficulty and hardship and adversity, you do not compromise. You don't just do what's convenient or what's easy. You do what is right. Because you have no idea how God will use you. We've also learned that while we have a tendency to look at adversity as if it's always bad and evil and something to be avoided, well, the truth is, if you're following God's path for your life, very often that path is going to run right through hardship and adversity. It won't be an accident. God will actually lead you to it. Why? Well, for one, there's no such thing as real Christian character that is formed without adversity. Jesus says, you pick up your cross and you follow me. If Jesus walks the way of adversity, Christians who are trying to be like him, to have his life and his character formed in them, must accept that we have to walk the path he walked. Pick up your cross and follow me. God shows up in the midst of hardship and adversity, and he does incredible things. Incredible things. It might be really bad, but God is working in it for good. And here's the promise. He says, I will be with you. He may lead you to hard times, but the promise is always, I will be with you. This is so true that when Moses asks about God's name, this is what God says, I will be who I will be. I will be with you. As if there's something essential about my character you do not discover until you just follow me to the places where I lead you, no matter how hard they are. But when you get on the way, it's on the road that you figure out who I am. I will be with you. Period. That is who God is. No matter what. So that's what we've been learning. This morning we're jumping ahead in the story quite a bit. We're jumping ahead to chapter 18. And if you had a chance to read between chapters 4 and 18, you'll recognize that we've really skipped over a lot of what is really essential to the story of Exodus. I mean, really, the Exodus proper. In those chapters, Moses goes to Pharaoh. He says, let God's people go. Pharaoh says, yeah, I don't think so. And God says, yeah, I knew that was going to happen. And then God begins to display his might, his wonder. You read about the 10 plagues of Egypt. You read about the Passover with the lamb that was sacrificed, and this kind of foreshadows Jesus. The lamb that was sacrificed, whose blood was placed over the door so that the angel of death passes over the houses of Israel, and this breaks the will of Pharaoh and all of Egypt, and the people of Israel are really pushed out of Egypt, and they just pack everything that they have very quickly, and then they go to their neighbors and ask for stuff, and the Egyptians give them treasures just like God said, and they don't even have time to let the bread rise, so they make unleavened bread, and they hit the road, and well, and then Pharaoh changes his mind again, and he sends his army out to get his slaves and to bring his slaves back, but God defends his people. They're caught between Pharaoh's army and the Red Sea, but Pharaoh's army can't get past this pillar of fire, and then the Red Sea is spread wide open, and the people of Israel walk through on dry ground, and then when Pharaoh's army tries to follow, the sea falls in on them. This is the great act of salvation. And then you get that song of Miriam where they're celebrating all the good things God has done. But if you took time to read chapter 4 to 18, what you notice is that even on the other side of salvation, it doesn't necessarily get any easier. Adversity remains, even on the other side of salvation. Adversity's still there. It's just changed, hasn't it? So if before the problem was Pharaoh and slavery, now the problem is the logistics of leadership for Moses. How do you lead a people who used to be slaves, now they're free in the wilderness? Well, they didn't pack a lot of food. They've gotten to the wilderness and sure, you can survive out there by yourself or in a small group, but there's just not the resource base to sustain a nation. And where do you get food? And when they get hungry, they get angry. Can anybody testify? Don't, not the right time. And they grumble against Moses. And I just have to imagine, like, Moses is like, can a guy catch a break? You just got out of slavery, and now you're whining already. So God fixes it. He provides bread from heaven, manna. And then they get to the mountain of the Lord, Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai. Same mountain, two different names. And they get there, and well, there's no water. And so they whine and complain. In fact, the whining and complaining got so bad, Moses was actually convinced that the people were going to rise up and stone him to death. They were that mad. And so God says, strike the rock, water will come out of it. He does. He takes his staff, strikes the rock, water. So now they have food, they have water. And no sooner do they have the basic necessities than they're attacked by the Amalekites. The Egyptians have been dealt with, but now the Amalekites come. And this time the Israelites have to get some skin in the game, because when Pharaoh sent his army out, they never drew a sword. I mean, God took care of all of it. Pillar of fire, Red Sea, they just walked. And they're delivered. But you notice that adversity has changed now, but it's still there. And I'm sure Moses is just irritated. And then you get to chapter 18. And all of a sudden, the pace of the narrative, of the story, it slows down a little bit. You get more of the details. You hear more about the relationships. And that's what I want to focus on. It's something of a reunion for Moses. He's led the people out to the wilderness, and once he gets to the mountain of God, Mount Horeb, his father-in-law Jethro comes and brings his wife and his two sons. Now, it's interesting in the story, the last time we saw his wife, they were headed to Egypt. So somewhere in the story, the Bible doesn't tell us when, Moses has sent his wife and children back to his father-in-law. We don't really know why. Presumably it's for their safety, their well-being, but this is something of a union, or really it's this chapter something of a union of the two dimensions of Moses' life. Remember, Moses' life can really be divided into three periods of 40 years. 40 years in Egypt, living in the courts, observing the suffering of his people. 40 years in Midian, where he has a family and a place and a quiet life. And then 40 years of delivering the people, leading them in the wilderness. This chapter represents kind of the bringing together of those first two periods. Moses has brought the people out of Egypt. His people are free, and now Jethro brings his family back to them. It's as if the two parts of Moses' life are being brought together for that last chapter. But what I want to read to you is just a couple verses about the relationship, the conversation between his father-in-law and himself, picking up in verse 6. And when he, that's Jethro, sent word to Moses, "I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons," Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and bowed down and kissed them. And they asked each other about their welfare and went into the tent. And then Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and all the hardship that had come upon them on the way, and how the Lord had delivered them. And Jethro rejoiced for all the good that the Lord had done to Israel, and that he had delivered them out of the hands of the Egyptians. So here's the thing about adversity. If you're going to survive it, if you're going to get through well, you will not go alone. This is just how God has made human beings. We were created for community. We were created for relationships. We were created for connection. And this is no less true when you're going through hard times than when times are good. If you're going to survive adversity, you need other people to go along with you. So when you find yourself in rough patches, it really helps to know who those Jethros are in your life. Notice what Jethro does. He shows up in Moses' life and he asks about his well-being. You need those people. You need people who show up in your life and say, "How are you doing? I've been thinking about you. I was worried about you. I care about you. Tell me how it is with your life. Tell me how it is with your soul. Are you doing okay?" You need these people in your life. You need people who are going to show up in your life, ask about your well-being, and then come into your tent and listen to your stories. This is so significant. One of the things we found as we launched our discipleship bands, typically how those groups begin is to get to know one another. You take sometimes several weeks sitting there, and each person is given the opportunity to tell their life story, the whole of it, however they want to tell it. The high points, the low points, the things that shape them into the person that they are, what God has done. And what we found is that lots of people say, "You know, I have never done that before. I've never thought about the whole story of my life, and I'd never had a group of people interested in hearing it out. But it's a powerful, powerful experience. Don't discount that. You need people who will walk into your tent, sit down, and listen to your stories, the good ones and the bad ones. You need people who are ready to hear when you're going through a hard time, and they'll just listen. That is so significant. And these people can be very, very hard to find. But man, you need to find the Jethros in your life who will listen to your story. And you need to have people in your life who, when things are going well, celebrate with you. And I don't know why, but in our culture today, these people are getting harder and harder to find. It is actually getting rather difficult to find somebody that, when you tell them the great things that are going on in your life, can respond with joy that is not tainted with envy or insecurity, but can really just hear what's going on and say, "That's great. I'm so happy for you. I'm so glad about what God is doing in your life." We need these people so desperately, who inquire about our well-being, listen to our stories, and celebrate the wins. You've got to identify those people in your life, and then you love them and you keep them close, because you don't get through adversity without those sorts of people in your life. So Jethro shows up into Moses' life, and he does all these things. But the chapter doesn't end there. It says, "And then the next day, Jethro gets to observe Moses' leadership style, and what he sees disturbs him a little bit, because Moses is dealing with people from the time the sun comes up to the time it goes down, and he's really doing everything for the community. In one regard, he acts as a judge. He acts as a mediator. Whenever there's a problem between these people, they bring the problem to Moses, and Moses has to arbitrate. Moses is the guy who has to fix everybody else's problems, and that can take a lot out of you. And he's also functioning as the teacher of Israel, because you have people that have been enslaved and now they have freedom, but what is evident is they don't know what to do with this freedom that they have. And so it's Moses who is trying to teach them how to live the way God would want you to live. So he's arbitrating disputes, he's teaching, but then he also functions in this prophetic seer type role, where anytime anybody wants to inquire of God, they go to Moses, and Moses has to talk to God on their behalf. And so this is what he's doing every day, all day. He's just dealing with people's problems and questions and trying to teach and all of this. And finally, Jethro says, "Moses, listen here. What you're doing, it ain't good. You are going to burn yourself out. You cannot keep doing what you're doing." What's amazing is the sort of response Moses doesn't give. This would be how I'd be tempted to respond if I'm Moses. I'd be like, "Jethro, listen, this ain't my first rodeo. I'm 80 years old. I've been around the block once or twice. And besides, between the two of us, I spent a lot more time with God. God revealed himself to me in the burning bush, not you. In fact, I get to see him all the time. We talk all the time, and it wasn't by your hand that these people were led out into the wilderness. I think I know what I'm doing." But he doesn't say that. He's offering Moses some constructive criticism, but can I highlight this? He only gets to do so because of what he's already done. You see, Jethro gets an audience with Moses. He gets to speak into his life because he's already showed up in his life and asked how he's doing, listened to his stories, and celebrated the win. He's created the sort of relationship that has the trust that Moses can hear what he's saying. And what I see a lot in life is a lot of people have lots of constructive criticism to offer other people. Just ask somebody what they think about politics and their leaders. They'll tell you. Loads of people with all sorts of ideas about how other people should do their jobs. But not that many people that are interested in doing the hard work of showing up into somebody's life, asking how they're doing, inquiring about their well-being, listening to their stories, and celebrating their wins. Jethro only gets to do the latter because he's done the work of the former. So you might just consider next time you want to tell somebody how it is, the next time you've got some constructive criticism on how somebody else should do their job, maybe you stop and say, what sort of relationship do I have with this person? Because it doesn't actually matter whether you're right or not. It really doesn't. It doesn't matter how smart you are or how insightful. If you don't have the relationship, they're not going to listen to you. You realize, right, that Moses had thousands of critics offering constructive criticism. Every time he made a decision, somebody had something to say about it. They were called the Israelites. And the Bible calls their criticism and advice grumbling. Build the relationship first. Show up in somebody's life and show them that you care, that you love them, that their well-being actually matters to you, and then all of a sudden, watch as the door is opened for you to speak truth into their life. And it's a good thing that Jethro had done this because he had good things to say. In fact, the way the story is written, it really highlights how God often works. I think we often expect God to show up and speak directly to us, but what the story highlights is how often when God wants to speak to us, he comes through another person. Because what Jethro says is treated as the word of God. And Jethro basically says that. He says, obey me, I'll give you advice, and God will be with you. And what he tells Moses is incredible. He says, Moses, what you're doing, it's not good. I don't care how often you talk to God. It hasn't made you Superman. You can't do this by yourself. You need help. Moses, you have to ask for help. Why is that so hard for us? I'm not the only one who doesn't like it. I know. Why is asking for help so stinking hard? I think there's a lot of reasons. The obvious one, right? It's pride. Asking for help requires me to humble myself, and my pride doesn't want to be humbled. And we all deal with this. Pride. I don't want to humble myself. I don't want to have to go to somebody else and say, you know what? I can't do this on my own. Can you please help me? Pride. And maybe it's the dumb form of pride. The dumb form of pride that has actually convinced you you don't need help. That even asking for help is not even a question you've considered. Like, you really think you're that good? None of us are that good. Moses wasn't that good. So maybe it's pride. Maybe it's control. Any other control freaks in the room? Perfectionists? Have you ever caught yourself saying, if you want it done right, you have to do it yourself? Guilty. Because to ask for help means that control is being taken out of our hands. It requires me to trust somebody else with my circumstances, with outcomes. That's hard, because I've convinced myself that as long as I keep my hands on the wheel, I can get myself to the outcomes that I want. But it doesn't work that way. But I don't want to let go, and so I don't want to ask for help. So maybe it's pride, maybe it's a control issue. It might be for you the backside of pride, which is shame. I don't want to ask for help because I'm concerned about perceptions. I don't want to ask for help because then you'll know how weak I am. If I ask for help, all of a sudden I become that sort of person, right? And I'm worried about what you think about me. I'm worried that if I ask for help, you'll somehow see inside of me. And what I'm really worried about is whether you'll think I'm worthy or not. Worthy of acceptance, connection, and belonging, all the things that human beings need. But if I can pretend that I'm strong, if I can continue to pretend that I have it all together, then maybe you'll believe it too. Shame. Maybe it's fear. Because what happens if you actually work up the courage and the humility to reach out and ask for help? To say, I'm not doing okay, can you please help me? And they say, no. Well, now I'm broken and alone. I need help and I feel isolated. Sometimes it's easier just to carry on in our misery than risk being told no. Asking for help is really, really hard. But let's be honest, what else are you going to do? We believe that God will be sufficient, yes. But God never intended the journey to be just me and Him. Sometimes the sufficiency of God is found in community and the resources of the community. So I realize it's hard. I realize you're going to have to fight your pride and you're going to have to learn humility and I'm going to have to let go of control and learn to trust others and I'm going to have to reach out and it's scary. But if we're going to make it through, we have to learn to ask for help. It doesn't matter how close you are to God. You'll never be Superman. God made you for community, and just because you're close to Him does not override the way He made you to be. We have to learn to ask for help. And when we do it, it's really, really good to know who those Jethros are in our life. Now, if you're sitting here this morning, and you're saying, I don't know who those people are in my life. I don't know if something bad was going on. I don't know who I would talk to. I don't know who I'd ask for help. I don't know who I could reach out to. I don't know if there's anybody who'd really show up in my life and care enough about me to ask about me and to take the time to hear my story. Well, can I suggest to you that the church might be a good place to start looking? I mean, ideally, this is the place where people find that sort of community. Ideally. Now, in practice, the reality is we're all a bunch of messed up, broken people. So it doesn't always work out that way. We're a bunch of people who are a little rough around the corners, and we don't always do what the Bible says we should do, even though we're the church. I get that. But this is a place of grace where the presence of Christ and the Holy Spirit dwells in our midst. And so what that means is even though we're broken, we're messed up, and we're rough around the edges, and we're all working on it together, there's something extra here that's not anywhere else. It's grace. It's the presence of Christ. And so sometimes that allows us to get over ourselves and be more than what we'd ever be on our own. So if you're looking for a Jethro in your life, can I commend the church to you? And in our church, what I would recommend, because it's the best way I know, it's a discipleship band. Take the time to show up and find the people who will ask about how you're doing, who will listen to your story and celebrate your wins. That's what our discipleship bands do. And so if you're looking, that would be a great place to start. They're not perfect because people aren't perfect. That's the best way I know. Now, some of you are sitting here this morning saying, you know what, I've got a really blessed life. I already know those people in my life. I can name them right now. I know the people that when things go wrong, I can call. And if I just need to talk or cry it out, they're there. And I can show up and they'll just listen. They're not going to try and fix anything. They're just going to listen. I've got those people. Then can I challenge you to ask yourself, who can you be Jethro for? Because the truth is, we live in a culture that deals with the problem of loneliness. We have all sorts of people that are lonely and feel isolated and disconnected. And we need people to be more intentional about being the person who shows up. Who do you know that could probably use a phone call and just say, hey, how are you doing? I care about you enough to pick up the phone and call. There are all sorts of people all around you that are dying for somebody just to listen to their story. Just to let them talk. You don't need to have any answers, just listen. Let them talk, that's answer enough. And they need somebody who will show up and celebrate the good things in their life and say, I'm so happy about the good things you're experiencing. I'm so happy about what I see God doing in your life. Who can you be Jethro for? Because I think that's just what it's like following Jesus. That's what Christianity is about, by the way. It's not just about saying a prayer one time and then showing up to church to make sure that you get a good report card when you die and go to heaven. That's a terrible way of thinking about the faith. Christianity are those of us who have heard the call of Jesus to take up our cross, follow him, be like him, and allow his spirit to live and dwell in us and change us from the inside out. And what that means is we just start doing the sorts of things that Jesus would do. And as I read the story, I just think these are the sorts of things Jesus would do. He would show up in people's lives. He'd celebrate the good. He'd listen to them. So who can you be Jethro to? Or maybe we just say it this way. Who can you be Jesus to? Yeah, it's a lot of hard work. And it requires a lot of intentionality. And it will cost you a lot of emotional energy. But that's what it is to be the church. The community of people who are committed to being Jesus for the world, for each other.